On July 14, 2021, the European Commission launched its largest regulatory initiative as part of the Green Deal, the Fit for 55 package. Some called it a seismic change. The proposed directive will basically affect the way Europe will deal with energy, resources, and transport until 2050. Since then, the Repower EU program was also announced, and this adds another layer of complexity. The intricacy of all these initiatives is almost impossible to grasp. In today's episode of the Fuel for Thought podcast, I'll be talking with Adriana Gerena Barena from Hydrogen Denmark and Ian Moore from Advision. We will explain the philosophy and goals of Fit for 55 and Repower EU and share some insight. Let's jump right in.
Sylvain, before we jump in, let's have a few of the abbreviations in the following episode explained.
Of course. So we selected five of them. Number one, CBAM. CBAM stands for Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. Number two, RFNBO, Renewable Fuels of Non-Biological Origin. Number three, ETS, Emission Trading Scheme. Number four, RED, Renewable Energy Directive. And number five, AFIR, Alternative Fuel Infrastructure Regulation.
And now we're ready.
It is my great pleasure today to welcome two good friends to discuss about one of my favorite topics, EU legislation and renewable fuels. So today we're welcoming Adriana Gerena Barena and Ian Moore. Adriana, how are you doing today?
Hi, good morning, and thank you for having me on today.
It is our pleasure. And then are you ready to discuss heavy topics about EU legislation?
Always, yeah.
Good, thank you. And Ian, welcome back. You were in our season three to discuss RED II, and today we'll discuss Fit for 55. So are you also fit for fight for today?
I am, and thanks for having me back. And so little has happened since the last one.
Indeed, so many things. So today's idea is to take a high-level picture about what is happening at EU level. So we have, of course, the Green Deal, Fit for 55, Repower EU, but what does the EU want? And with a special emphasis on renewable fuels. And then we'll have a second episode discussing in more details, okay, what about e-fuels, what about aviation fuel, and so forth. But before we proceed, can you both say a few words about yourself, a bit about your background, and the company, the organization you work for? So maybe, Adriana, would you like to start?
Yes, thanks. I'm Adriana Gerena Barena, and I'm Head of Regulatory Affairs and Analysis at Brennbranchen, or Hydrogen Denmark, which is the industry association for hydrogen and power to X here in Denmark. So we cover the entire value chain with all our 33 members.
Good, perfect. Thank you, Adriana. Ian, do you want to say a few words about yourself and your organization, maybe as well?
Thank you. Yes, Ian Moore. I'm based in the UK. I'm a chemical engineer by background, and currently I'm technical director in a low carbon team of Visium, which is the technical consulting arm of a wider Worley engineering company. So Worley is about 50,000 people worldwide. We have about 2,000 in a Visium and perhaps about 40 working in a low carbon team. And basically, we help our clients develop low carbon strategies and start their decarbonisation journeys. And most of our work is sort of technical study work, but obviously we need to keep abreast of evolving policy and legislation around the world in sort of all aspects of the energy transition, which is something I particularly focus on.
So as mentioned, a lot of things are happening at the EU level. So energy transition, climate change, geopolitics, energy independence, cost of living crisis. So I'm not sure where to start because we could spend a lot of time on each of these topics, but maybe, Adriana, how do you see what's happening at EU level in Brussels? What are the priorities right now for the EU Commission, for example?
So on the energy front, I guess it's obvious energy has become more than just a matter of energy and climate, but also a geopolitical issue. So Fit for 55, in a way, and in the most basic definition of what it is, I guess is a natural continuation of the efforts that the EU had going on renewable energy and decarbonization up to 2020. So we've had a lot of legislation coming into place at EU level in the 90s and the early 2000s, and all of them more or less had targets around 2020. So there was a natural wave of of a review and reform of the legislation that existed at that time when we were reaching that 2020 deadline with the objective of extending and increasing the ambition towards 2030. So I guess that's the basic part of what Fit for 55 is about. But of course, at the same time, the world has changed in many ways, and some might be more obvious than others. What I'm talking about is, of course, the geopolitical situation Europe is in. And so here, Fit for 55 also serves the purpose of, let's say, defending Europe's geopolitical position in the world. And here, of course, the war in Ukraine is a big part of it, but there's something before that that also means a lot for the role of Fit for 55, and specifically, as we'll talk about later as well, the role of hydrogen in it. I would like to highlight two events or sets of events. One being just generally the position of the EU in the world, seeing that China is growing and taking over more and more geopolitical weight. So at some point, the EU had to figure out what is their role, right? What is our role as Europeans? We're not winning the industrial race. We're not winning the technological race, but we can definitely win the green race, and hence the special role of Fit for 55 on that front. And then also, let's say with Afghanistan, there was a bit of an existential crisis as well. And again, a reminder that we're not winning those races with digitalization and then again, the military race, if you will. But so we can position ourselves on the green front, on energy independence and so on.
Thank you, Adriana. Very, very good point. Ian, do you have anything to add, or what is your view on these topics?
Yeah, that's a good introduction. Perhaps we should say that the name Fit for 55, the 55 comes from the 55% reduction between 1990 and 2030. And, you know, as part of this new wave of legislation, there's been a lot of concentration, for example, on transport fuels and on industry. And this talk about ETS2 to extend that further into, I guess, transport end use and buildings and other sectors. So I think there's a sort of expansion of the scope to include sectors which weren't included in a sort of previous packages. And some of this is about generating new fuels for the future. And obviously, hydrogen is part of that. And some of it is using the fuels we already currently use more efficiently and things around it. You know, if we're using gas, tracking the methane emissions associated with that gas. So it is a very comprehensive sort of package going forwards.
I agree. And I think we'll discuss in detail later. So all you mentioned ETS, but also the CBAM, RED III, and so forth, but also so which segments are affected, because it's more than transport, it's industry. I often heard that, yeah, this is one of the most ambitious legislative package at EU level, because it's really, for me, it's a revolution. Let's go through technical discussion, but it's a question for Adriana especially, because I think you spend more time than Ian and I possibly on understanding this. Is how does EU legislation work at EU level? So who is proposing? Are all the proposed regulations coming from the parliament? Is it the commission? Can we review? What is the role of the industry? Can you send feedback? Can you say a few words? And I guess it's complicated, but in a simple way, could you enlighten us about this topic?
Sure. So the EU works essentially like any country, right? You'll have the council, which is, let's say, the government. You have the commission, which is what would be the relevant ministry. And you have the parliament, which, of course, is like the parliament in any country. So the initiative to develop new legislation can come from any of them. Normally, it will be the commission that actually works through the details of what the legislation or regulation should look like and send out the proposal for how it should look like. There will be a public consultation typically of between 2 to 4 weeks where industry and citizens can send their comments and their opinions about how this looks like, what should be changed in the proposal. And they'll issue a final version that then goes on to negotiation with the council and the parliament, which each of them will also develop their position and opinions to the proposal and will then enter into a phase known as the trilogue, where the three parties will get together to reach a final final agreement on how the legislation should look. And then it enters into force at EU level, and then typically member states have a period to implement it into national law, depending on what type of rule it is. Sometimes it has direct applicability once it's in force at EU level, and sometimes it needs to be, let's say, translated into national law.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. That was crystal clear. Thank you so much, Adriana.
I think one thing I find a little bit confusing, or I think it obviously a democratic process is very important, and the way the different stakeholders are engaged is very important. I think when outsiders try to follow the discussion, say on social media, it's easy to mistake a sort of final position versus a part of the negotiations. I remember a colleague of mine telling me that they've seen organic chemicals and plastics have been added to the carbon border adjustment mechanism. And it turned out that was a sort of European Parliament amendment suggestion, but obviously it's not final until it's final. So I think as these negotiations take place in public and different numbers get proposed and changed on the way to the final destination, I think if you sort of read in press releases, you can think a number is a final number when in fact it's still part of the ongoing sort of negotiations.
It's true. Adriana, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think part of it is I think we still live in a world where the general population sometimes struggles to understand exactly what each EU institution does and how the whole process works. And so it's easy to take the news of some proposal as something being implemented already. And then, of course, there's also part of the game, lobbyists trying to create a little bit of drama around the issues they care about, and so making it sound more firm than something actually is.
Yes, I think a lot of documents are leaked sometimes, and then drafts that are not finished, and it creates, at least for me, confusion. Sometimes I agree with Ian, it's not easy to know, okay, what is the latest version, which number should we use? So, Adriana and Ian, question for both of you. Let's say the Commission is proposing something. Let's look at RED II. Will it be our RED III? Will there be massive changes after public consultation and the trilogue? Or is it, what I've seen is that it's often, we're always getting back to something quite close to the initial proposal, but maybe, I don't know enough maybe, but what is your take on this?
Ian, do you want to go first this time?
Yeah, I think the direction we travel always stays the same. And I think you're probably right that there's lobbying, and then different numbers get suggested, and probably the final number is quite close to where it started out.
Yeah, I would say normally the number is not radically different, but there's always changes around. I mean, the level of ambition itself typically changes a little bit, but then there's something about how firm the commitment is, right? Whether it's a mandate or if it's more of a suggestion from the Commission that member states should aim at this level. And that's really what matters in the end, right? It doesn't mean much if you have an ambition of decarbonizing, let's say, 70%, but in reality, really, is only a recommendation, and that's what we often see happening with along the process, going through Parliament and especially the Council, that they water down the level of commit very often.
Ian, you mentioned Fit for 55, which is the goal is to decrease by 55% emission in 2030. How do you visualize Fit for 55? Because it's 12 or 14 regulations. So for me, I see it as like transport is affected, and we have goals about greenhouse gas emission, the part on sustainability, some on taxes, some on energy savings. Yeah, I don't know. How would you describe Fit for 55 for dummies, maybe? Ian?
I think it's a sort of combination of strengthening the sort of existing legislation and making the targets more aggressive to in line with a 55, and obviously then we see the sort of new components coming in, like the refuel EU aviation, the maritime, the potential carbon border adjustment mechanism. So yeah, a mixture of strengthening the targets, which say came under the sort of RED II legislation, and then bringing in sectors which haven't been covered beforehand.
Adriana?
Yeah, exactly. I think Ian covered it pretty well. I guess it's a 360 degree analysis of existing regulation to make sure that it is fit for a 55% reduction. So it goes everything from, yeah, what Ian just mentioned, right? All these sectors, but also, for example, energy taxation, making sure that the ways we tax energy are not the historical reasons around supporting the industry and so on, but also to decarbonize. And then, as Ian mentions, introducing new elements like, for example, regulation around decarbonizing aviation and shipping.
And there's also an element in there regarding infrastructure and I guess particularly if we look to low carbon gases and what might be required.
And actually, I think it's a good time now to discuss. We cannot discuss a certain piece of legislation, but let's take a few one and then we can see what it's about and what would be the main changes. Should we start with ETS, emission trading? Is it Adriana or Ian? Do you want to say a few words about that? What is it doing now and what are the proposed changes?
Sure. So the emission trading system is a pretty smart market mechanism to basically live up to the principle of polluter pays. So industry in Europe, for each ton of CO2 they emit to the atmosphere, they have to pay a certain amount of money. And that certain amount is defined by the market, where the EU creates scarcity by limiting the amount of permits available for these emissions, right? So they say this year you can maximum emit so many tons of CO2, and so trade between yourselves and to get the permits to emit. And those that do not achieve permits will have to reduce their that don't buy the permits have to reduce their emissions, typically by adapting their production processes. The ETS, again, from my perspective, very smart mechanism, but has some challenges coming to life where the price was too low. There were too many allowances or emission permits out there. And so the price wasn't...
So Adriana, free allowances, it's basically a permit to pollute. You don't have to pay. You can pollute so much and you only pay if you pollute, if you emit more. Is that how to understand it?
Well, there's two things here. You have the allowances, the regular allowances that you have to pay for, but then to address the risk of what it's called carbon leakage, meaning that factories would move, let's say, for example, to Asia, where environmental and climate requirements are lower. Some industries that are at this risk of carbon leakage, they receive some allowances for free to make sure they stay in Europe.
Aviation has free allowances, correct?
Aviation has some free allowances. Yeah, some sectors have pretty much all free allowances, like fossil hydrogen production today has mostly free allowances. Yeah.
And I think there are some tweaks planned for the ETS. For example, I think waste incineration is planned to come under the EU ETS to try and drive plastics recycling. I think aviation, I think the free allowance is potentially be phased out there. And I think there's a plan to sort of cover not just flights within Europe, but sort of all international flights departing to and taking off from Europe. So, some smaller changes to the ETS, but I agree with Adriana that I guess that's after years of experience, that's more finely tuned to get, I guess, EU or carbon prices in the range that the EU would like to help drive change.
I mean, I would say that actually the changes proposed to ETS are quite significant. It's true there's been quite a bit of fine-tuning over the years to make sure that the price was stronger, and we've already started experiencing a stronger price per allowance in the market, but they're introducing something more solid to make sure that the price actually stays high and gets higher. And this is mostly by doing two things, strengthening or rebasing the cap. As I said, there's a maximum amount of allowances per year. And basically this cap is both going to be reduced at once, but also start reducing faster year by year going forward.
Is it this 4% something, 4.1 or...
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's 4.2, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. But yeah, basically, this is going to have a very big impact in the incentive to invest in greener technologies going forward.
Aren't they going to include marine and road, or did I?
Yes. So shipping will be included. I mean, there's some limits to what ships go in and which one won't. It depends on the size of the ship and so on and the routes. But yeah, shipping will be included gradually, but sort of directly into the regular ETS in the coming years, or at least that's the commission proposal. And road transport will have kind of its own...
Yes, a parallel one.
A little ETS, yeah, together with buildings, according to the commission's proposal.
I think the intention at the moment is that at least in the first few years, that will just cover heavy goods vehicle and not sort of private cars. And effectively, that tax will be paid by the fuel suppliers and probably passed on to the end user. But we won't be collecting it off the individual purchases.
Basically, one significant tax on carbon. And Adriana, you mentioned carbon leakage, which is basically companies or industry leaving Europe. And to avoid that, they are creating this, or the way I understood it, this carbon border adjustment mechanism. I know the Commission doesn't want to call it a tax, but for me, it's still a tax. Ian, can you say a few words about this CBAM?
Yes, I think it's intended for two things. One is to sort of protect European industry from, again, carbon leakage that Adriana mentioned. And I think secondly, is generally trying to encourage the rest of the world to impose similar taxes to the carbon taxes to the EU. So basically, for a certain set of goods and products coming into the EU from regions where there is no carbon tax or the carbon tax is lower than the EU, then basically there will be a charge to pay on those imports equating to the CO2 used in production and the delta between the tax in a country it comes from versus the, I think it's like the average of the last month ETU price. So I think it's coming in 2023, 2024. The first couple of years are more of a put a system in place and record the data prior to actual costs and kicking in. Due to the free allowances that some industries get at the moment in Europe, there's going to be a period where those allowances are phased out, and hence that will reduce the impact of CBAM on importers to Europe until the point those free allowances have been gone. And there's been a lot of negotiation as to how quickly those free allowances will be phased out. There's been a lot of discussion around which sectors to include. Almost certainly it will include electricity, iron and steel, cement, aluminium, I think it is. There has been lobbying around extending that to include organics, chemicals, plastics, I think hydrogen, ammonia. I think that's still up for debate. I think one question that industry has is, concern they have is regarding European companies that are exporting products abroad, because they will lose the free allowances, but then they won't be protected or they'll be disadvantaged because they'll still be paying a carbon tax in Europe. So I know that's been one area of concern, but this is an important legislation. It has a big impact on countries like Turkey and other countries around the EU that rely particularly on the EU for trading and concern to them. It just remains to be seen how quickly this will be implemented.
Yes. Adriana, do you think CBAM will be implemented? Because I've heard that some countries are actually appealing to the World Trade Organization, saying that we're breaking rules if we do that. What is your take on this?
I think the Commission and other actors in the regulatory world have been pretty thorough in figuring out ways in which the CBAM can be designed to fit also with the WTO rules. So I don't think it's a matter of whether it will be or will not. I think it's a matter of when. If they don't get it done the first time around, they will definitely succeed the second time around. So I'm quite confident that it will be implemented before 2030.
Excellent. Okay, so that was about carbon tax, so inside and outside EU with trade. Let's talk about fuels, which is what I like also. So I see fuels covered in three types of legislation. So we have RED II, RED III, Refuel EU Aviation, Fuel EU Maritime. And we'll discuss that in part two of this podcast with more details. But in a few words, what do they do, these three pieces of legislation? I don't know, Adriana?
Yeah, so RED II or RED III, the Renewable Energy Directive, and it introduces a general target for how much renewable energy should be used in the EU, and then also some specific sectoral targets, so specific for transport, for industry and heating and so on. And then we have Refuel EU and Refuel EU Aviation and Fuel EU Maritime. And funnily enough, they do two different things with the same objective. Refuel EU Aviation is more in line with RED II or RED III, where it introduces specific renewables requirements for aviation, whereas Fuel EU Maritime actually introduces emission reduction requirements, which is a little bit different in the sense that you could still use a fossil fuel that emits less than the one that you're using now.
For me, Fuel EU Maritime time is a bit like LCFS. It's a carbon intensity reduction. And basically, the industry, it's more an American way to see it. Please, industry, decarbonize, do your own way, and very few rules on pathway, sub-mandates, or feedstock. It's much more flexible. Ian, what is your take on this RED 2-3 fuel EU maritime and refuel EU aviation? Do you have anything else to add to what Adriana just said?
As you just said, we're seeing the EU maybe give more of an opinion as where it wants certain fuels to be used. And I think, well, in maritime, I think it's very much technology agnostic. As you say, set a standard and let people choose how to achieve it. But I think, I guess we'll come on to renewable fuels of non-biological origin and things like e-fuels and renewable hydrogen. But I mean, we're seeing the end of a combustion engine by 2035. And I think the door is slightly ajar for things like e-fuels in there. But I think directionally, the EU sees road transport as something that, you know, electrification is a solution for that. So I think it's trying to drive things like renewable hydrogen and biofuels and e-fuels to sectors that can't easily be electrified. And again, with aviation, we're seeing targets both for the use of sustainable aviation fuel, but also mandates for potentially for different types of fuel. So I think we've seen maybe more subtlety from the EU as to trying to direct solutions in areas where it thinks, you know, they're hard to decarbonize sectors.
Yes, I agree. Adriana, anything else to add to what Ian just said?
No, I don't think so. He made it pretty clear.
Good. So Ian, you mentioned the end of a combustion engine. So that's for light duty and it's 2035. So we won't be able to buy combustion engine cars from 2035, which is a big change. I think the industry wanted zero carbon emission involved. So basically, fuel with no CO2 emissions, but they decided to go for, basically only electric vehicles. So that's how I understand it.
Yeah, I think we should bear in mind that it does take a long time for the existing fleet to disappear. So it's not like there'll be no internal combustion engine cars driving around in 2036, but obviously, it does have a major turning point for the industry.
Yes, and it's highly connected to my next point, which is the infrastructure. And I know it's something Adriana likes this. No, but it's true, which was a directive and now might be a regulation about infrastructure. So, Adriana, can you say a few words about this?
Mm-hmm. I'll try to say it in a few words because, as you said, I love this topic and I'm very worried about it. There was this directive called Alternative Fuel Infrastructure Directive or Fueling Infrastructure Directive. And what it did was essentially ask member states to create their own plans and ambitions to how much infrastructure of alternative fuels there should be rolled out. Problem with this was that member states didn't really live up to their plans if they developed it at all. And also there was pretty much no consistency between the plans of different countries, right? So there was a risk that there wouldn't be interoperability in this infrastructure. Let's say that you wouldn't have the same type of charging infrastructure for an electric vehicle in Spain and Portugal, and so you couldn't drive across borders, right? So to avoid this risk, the Commission is now proposing to turn this directive into a regulation, whereby the Commission then has more control over the plans and can introduce some mandatory targets at EU level and can also introduce some requirements around this interoperability. And then that is all great. It also includes now specific targets for hydrogen infrastructure. So you can drive cars and especially trucks with hydrogen and be sure that you will be able to refuel along the way. But we are seeing some going back to the legislative process, we're seeing that especially the Council is a little bit reluctant to have too many commitments on this front. They're scared of having stranded assets and things like that, and so they're trying to water down a little bit the commitments for now and push a stronger commitment towards 2024.
And Adriana, so it's also about charging stations for electric vehicles, correct? It's not only hydrogen.
Yeah, exactly. It's all alternative fuels, if you will. So there are targets for electric charging, hydrogen refueling, but also in some of the transport subsegments, there's also targets, for example, for maritime, for LNG refueling and so on.
Okay, so it's a whole infrastructure. I see. All of this looks really nice and very ambitious, but who is going to pay for this? And this will be expensive also for all the citizens. So is the EU also considering, in terms of funding, how much would they support that? Does it come with funding or, how does that work? Do you have any words, any thoughts about this topic? I don't know, Adriana or Ian?
Sure. I mean, some of it will come with support. Either from the EU, I mean, they already have a wide range of support mechanisms, also from member states, but a lot of it is market driven, right? They introduce a mandate, and since it's mandatory, market actors have to live up to it. And so in the end, it's us as consumers that will pay, no matter whether it's a subsidy that we pay through our taxes or if it's a mandate that we pay directly at the pump, if you will.
At one point, they had this Just Transition Fund. I don't know if it's still, or how it's called now, if it's still there, but it was a few hundred billion, a lot of money, like basically to help people to make this transition fairer also for buildings and heat and electricity. Is it still something that's being studied by the Commission, Adriana or Ian?
I'm not super familiar with it, but yes, it still exists now. And I mean, there's all kinds of funds on this front, and you know, with this intention also to make sure that the transition is fair between member states. And so some of the support mechanisms, also regional support instruments that the EU has, are targeted at specific member states or regions to make sure that they can follow along without being left behind.
Ian, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think also I'm not an expert in this area either, but around the, you know, the ETS and the ETS2 sort of recycling of the money which is collected through that, I think there's something called the Social Climate Fund, but basically there are procedures or methodologies, I'm not sure what you call it, to try and help those hardest hit by some of these.
Okay, so we talk infrastructure, taxes, fuels, but are there any other segments? We mentioned a bit industry, but maybe chemicals, I don't know, ammonia, cement factories, steel, maybe fertilizer company. Are those affected by all these changes and Fit for 55? Ian, what is your take, maybe, I don't know, on this?
Yeah, this is probably a good time to come back to these renewable fuels and non-biological origin, which would cover something like renewable hydrogen or green hydrogen production, and also the products made from that green hydrogen or the fuels made from that green hydrogen. So I guess if you take CO2 as well, you can then make electro fuels or recycle carbon fuels. So there is an industry target for the use of RFNBO and sort of hydrogen in industry. So where hydrogen is used as a feedstock or as a fuel, there is an intent that the numbers vary in the negotiations, but let's say 50% use of green hydrogen or RFNBOs. For hydrogen use, it's the renewable hydrogen use. So I think, industry being brought into the into that area, that's something which is quite new. And there are a lot of open questions regarding the production of these recycled fuels using CO2 and what CO2 can be used and what cannot be used. The intent of the EU, I think, is very much in the short term that fossil fuel-derived CO2 is a potential solution out to, I think, 2035. But beyond that point, they really only want biogenic CO2 to be used in the production of what would we call e-fuels.
So that would be a CO2 produced, let's say, by a steel factory. You can make fuels out of it until 2035, and then that's about it. Is that how you understand it?
That's right. So there's a sunset clause at the moment. So beyond 2035, then you wouldn't get the incentives if it's fossil fuel derived. But I think it's quite an intense debate still going on that topic, because you have a sort of cement industry which is producing CO2 from the decomposition of limestone as well as from combustion of fuels. And some people refer to that as not to abate emissions. And then the iron and steel sector, as you mentioned, you effectively produce a syngas from the industry, and that's iron and steel was considered a hard to abate sector. So I think there's quite a lot of discussion as to not treat all fossil fuel derived CO2 the same way, and maybe give some allowances or grandfathering or allow use of that CO2 to make fuels to occur for a longer period of time. Because, I mean, the reality is that, you know, if you're a project developer, you bring either 20-year payback for your project to go ahead. So, you're going to lose all the financial incentives in 2035. You're pretty much killing that project dead already. So I think that really has to be sorted out. And yeah, for the cement industry and iron and steel and anyone really wanting to make synthetic methanol, knowing what CO2 you can use is a very important topic.
Yes, I agree. Adriana, what is your thoughts on this Fit for 55 and how it's going to affect industries like steel, cement, fertilizers, and industry in general? What is your take on this?
Well, Ian already went into how, especially in the realm of the Renewable Energy Directive, industry is impacted with this specific target on hydrogen consumption. But I guess there are two others. Of course, ETS, the whole point of ETS, so the European Trading System or Emission Trading System, is to cover emissions from industry. So all the changes coming from ETS will affect industry. And then we also have the gas decarbonization and hydrogen package, which is a revision of the gas directive and gas regulation that introduces some targets for decarbonizing the gas system as well. Again, this before Ukraine and before RepowerEU, so I guess we'll see even more of that going forward. But that also means something to the costs that industry will be facing around their gas consumption, because there will be more green gas coming to the grid over the years.
So in a few words, Adriana, what is this RepowerEU about, and what are some specific targets maybe?
So RepowerEU is the EU's plan, put bluntly, to become independent of Russian gas. So what it does is increase different renewable energy targets, but also introduce proposals to accelerate the deployment of renewable energy. So, for example, we have new proposals around how member states and local authorities should grant permits for these projects to be built and so on. We also have a significant increase in targets for hydrogen production, renewable hydrogen production domestically, so at EU level, but also for imports of green hydrogen into the EU. Now, the funny thing about RepowerEU is that it comes on the back of negotiations still ongoing for Fit for 55. So basically, we didn't even have time to implement Fit for 55, and we're already increasing the targets through another mechanism. So it will be fun to see how it all plays together by next year.
Ian, I've heard that biogas might be involved in RepowerEU. Do you know anything about that, or have you read anything?
I think there is obviously an intention to, dramatically stimulate more biogas production within the EU. How that exactly fits with the RepowerEU, I'm not entirely sure, but I guess RepowerEU is about securing alternative energy supplies. So, yeah, that could be a significant factor. The other aspect I was going to perhaps draw upon, and which Adriana touched on, is that, this target for 10 million tons of EU hydrogen imports by 2030 under it. So, we may think this discussion on EU legislation only really applies to people in the EU, but obviously any exporter or potential exporter of hydrogen into the EU is looking very closely at this legislation. And, we know, North Africa, Middle East, even places like Chile and Namibia, Central Asia are all potentially looking to supply green hydrogen to Europe. And how this will be enacted, and whether, the RFNBO criteria will be applied also to the imports, and how you take rules set based on sort of European industry and apply those to different countries and criteria becomes very important. So there's a large number of people looking in from the outside into the EU trying to figure out what the regulations will be around green hydrogen production and whether it would be economic to import into the EU. That is, a very important area also.
Thank you, Ian. I don't have any further questions for you for now, for today. So I don't know if you have any not famous last words, but any words to summarize this discussion. So if you had to explain all this, what's happening at EU, what is the goal exactly? Is it to be, our goal is to be carbon neutral in 2050, correct? And to be more maybe independent, that EU would be self-sufficient. That's really for me how I see it. But then a lot of details. Adriana, Ian, how would you like to conclude this discussion?
I think besides what you said, the two main takeaways on our side is the need for speed and the fact that green investment is definitely a good investment from now on.
Yeah, I think going back to that initial context we gave, that we're in this cost of living crisis, and I guess there'd be one argument that says, well, can we afford to do all of this now? What is the cost of this? Whereas we've all been following the news over the summer about droughts, and I guess more recently Pakistan and floods, and can we really afford the cost of not doing this? So I think it's going to be painful getting through the next few years, but I think this legislation puts us into a much stronger position through to 2030 and keeps the EU on course for its long-term goals. So it's of extreme importance.
Thank you so much, Adriana and Ian, for a very useful discussion. I hope our listeners didn't get lost in acronyms and abbreviation, but that was a bit of a EU introduction, hopefully, for everybody. Thanks again, and I'm looking forward to our second podcast where we'll go into details to discuss, RFNBO, what are the sub-targets, what happens for road, aviation, shipping, and open up the discussion, what is next. Thank you so much to both of you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Sylvain, that was amazing to hear. I must admit, I had to listen to it twice because it's so information-packed. But if you were a refiner or a fuel producer in EU or outside, what would your recommendations be if you want to produce for the European market?
First of all, the good news is that EU will need a lot of renewable fuels. So maybe if RED III is voted as such, as proposed by the European Commission, it would be maybe 25% of all the fuels we need in EU will have to be renewable, which is massive.
I have a question.
Yes.
Fit for 55.
Yes.
Is that now a legislation or is it a suggestion?
Okay, we are in October 2022, and hopefully a lot of this legislation, directive regulations, will be in place either at the end of the year or Q1 23.
So it's still being negotiated?
So the Commission made a proposal. A lot of these proposals have been discussed at the European Parliament, who made amendments. And now it's called, many of them, it's entering the trilogue phase. A trilogue, so it's a EU language. It's a dialogue with three. A trilogue, so it's EU Council.
Ah, trilogue. Okay, trilogue. Yes. Now I get it.
Yes, so trilogue, not dialogue, trilogue. So it's discussion between the European Commission, European Parliament, and the EU Council. And they are discussing, agreeing. So let's see. A lot of the amendments done by the Parliament are actually much more progressive. If you take SAF, for example, sustainable aviation fuel, the Commission proposed 63% aviation fuel in 2050, and the Parliament proposed 100%.
What?
Yes. So it's so let's see if they will cut the apple in two, as you say, or where they will end. Normally, what I've seen is that you go back to the European Commission proposal, but the Parliament, which is still a young institution, is getting working on its muscles, and I think they have been more, they have had more and more influence at the EU level. So let's see what happens. But so right now in October, still being discussed.
Okay, getting back to you're a fuel producer inside EU or outside. So if you're, if you're both, what is your recommendation?
Okay, first of all, understand EU legislation, all the details, the devil hides in the details, as we say. So, and understand exactly in which member state this will be implemented. You are based, say, in Argentina or Brazil or, South Korea. You want to export fuels to Denmark. Do the homework. Understand what exactly, how does all these regulations will be implemented in the member state. And it's not done yet. So that's why. Homework.
It's about following the legislation continually.
Yeah, exactly. And what matters at EU is where the fuel is used, not where the fuel is produced. So understand feedstock requirement, greenhouse gas requirements, mandates. Maybe in some member states you can get credits for fuel blending and so forth. Also maybe tax reduction. So do the homework also for the business case. So it's really, really important. And if you have the feedstock, it's what we say, you are king of the world. So if you have the right feedstock, it could be really, really relevant for you because Europe will need a lot of renewable fuels for road, marine, and aviation.
Yeah, and the legislation is so strong here that it might be that you have some legislation in the country where you are producing also for renewable fuels, but it might pay off to ship it to Europe.
Exactly, because so the EU is not giving incentives to produce fuels unlike US, but they are putting mandates in place which will create a market, and the price will be high because there will be a high demand. So it will be the prices will be market driven due to the legislation. So I think that will be that will create a big market because we will need, as mentioned, renewable fuels for aviation, road, and marine. And also the industry has some targets in CO2 reduction. They have to use e-fuels or Power2X, RFNBO.
And that draws back to the point that it's very important to know the legislation in the country where you're exporting to, because otherwise you might not, your product might not have the value that you think it has.
Exactly. So, but again, a lot of opportunities. Don't think limitation, but think impact and opportunities. But there's a lot.
There's some work connected to it.
Yes, indeed.
I think one of the things that is very interesting about this trend or this legislation is that we used to have, for example, ultra low sulfur diesel in EU. We still do.
Yes.
Maximum 10 ppm of sulfur in your diesel. Mm-hmm. That's a specification.
Yes.
There are, of course, still specifications.
Yes.
But the specification is, of course, important, but it's much less impactful than the legislation.
Yes, I think I've been saying that for many years now. I think the fuels is entering...
Okay, I finally listened.
No, but not... sorry, Michaela. But it's entering the world of regulation. Like fuels, for me at least, as a... technical provider, like catalyst and technology providers, we used to look at spec, I don't know, smoke point of jet, freezing point, cloud point, sulfur, and so forth, you name it, nitrogen. But now, all this fuel discussion, of course, this is still there, this is critical because you don't want the plane to crash, for example.
Yes.
But it's entering the world of regulatory affairs. And maybe a refinery sees that, for them, it has been there for a long time, but it's really not what I see. Fuels are entering, moving from specification to regulation. That's really a trend we see in Europe, US, Canada, and so forth. So it's a really a change of paradigm, I think.
Yeah, and I think for each refiner, it's also up to, especially the European refineries who are under this legislation by geography, it is to understand what is the impact for your refinery right now and in the future.
Yes, like also because, for example, road transport will be electrified. So how much gasoline and diesel do you want to do? Of course, there will be a heavy duty and a medium duty. But so prepare for the future. It's what we always say. But understand how it will impact road fuels, aviation. If you do marine fuels, do you need to start looking at ammonia, methanol, or maybe marine biofuels? A lot of these fuels will need hydrogen. So how do you want to produce your low greenhouse gas hydrogen? And that's really a key. Is it with carbon capture, green, renewable? Think about it. And they are already doing it, so I don't need to tell them what to do. But it's really...
But what we also see is that this legislation is also driving a conversation in a completely different direction than what we have been used to. It's driving it towards the energy transition. So despite the fact that Fit for 55 has not yet been completely finalized, it is driving the decisions, it's driving the right direction.
People know that in 2050, we'd have to be carbon neutral in Europe. So that's really, it's happening. Some are more or less prepared, some are more or less feedstock, but it's really, this is a general movement. So it's really a change of philosophy and approach, I think.
Interesting. I look forward to the next part.
Good. Thank you, Michaela. Me too.
Well, that just about wraps up this episode of the Fuel for Thought podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. We'd be happy to help you if you have any questions. And don't forget to like and share the podcast with your colleagues, friends, and family. Next time, Sylvain will continue the conversation on EU legislation with Adriana and Ian. There's more to it than you might think, so don't miss out on the wealth of knowledge they'll bring to the table. Until then, from Sylvain and me, it's time to say thanks for listening. Take care and goodbye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.